So today we're going to have a panel discussion, and the point is basically just to introduce some varying alternative career paths outside of academia and get some perspectives from people that have taken that path but come from a physics background. So we have three panelists here. The way this is going to go is we're going to have each of them do a little introduction of themselves after I introduce them, and then I'll get the ball rolling by asking a few questions, and then we'll open up a general discussion, and I hope it really is a conversation. So please think of questions that you might have for our panelists while they're talking, and then we'll go from there and see how things progress. So we're very happy to be joined first by Abdallah Rukin, who's the Vice President and Chief Risk Officer at Polar Securities. So he is based in Toronto, and he did his PhD in theoretical physics at McMaster University. I learned in nuclear physics. And then he joined the Bank of Nova Scotia in 1997 as the risk market manager. And in 2000, he was appointed the assistant general manager, heading a group responsible for managing the market risk of traded products. And in 2006, he became vice president responsible for structured transactions and hedge fund risk management at Bank of Nova Scotia. And then in January 2008, he joined Polar as a risk officer, chief risk officer. Next, we have Neil Constable, who is the partner and head of quantitative and equity research at GMO Boston. He leads the quantitative research effort at GMO's global equity team. And prior to joining GMO in 2006, he was a quantitative researcher at State Street Global Markets and also a postdoctoral fellow at MIT. So Neil did his master's at Cambridge. He did a BS at University of Calgary, and he received his PhD in physics from McGill University, and Rob Myers was his supervisor. So thank you for joining us, Neil. And then finally, we have Jorge Escobedo, who is the co-founder and chief scientist at Canopy Labs. And probably a lot of you know Jorge because he used to be based here at Perimeter Institute where he did his PhD. So he was in string theory here. He earned his PhD in theoretical physics from University of Waterloo in 2012. He was a Huygens scholar in 2007, studied at the University of Amsterdam for his master's in and obtained his master's in theoretical physics in 2008. And he has extensive experience in mathematical modeling and analysis, as well as data mining and data analytics. So with that, why don't we open it up for a little introduction by each of our panelists here, and we'll start with Abdallah.
Sure. I just want to ask the audience a little bit. How many of you are curious about a job in finance? Okay. How many of you are curious about the theories of finance? Okay, so there's a lot more interest in theory and some curiosity about jobs. Okay. I did a PhD in physics, and I'm from Libya, so they sponsored me to come here, and so I went back. Felt obligated and felt the right thing to do. All my colleagues and supervisors were saying, "You're crazy," but I went, and turned out to be a mistake. And I was a bit too outspoken, and I got into trouble with the political police, and in Libya, I left. I got too scared. I just couldn't sleep anymore. And I left. I could have joined that fight. 20 years later, we would have won, but, you know. And some of my friends who were sidelined at the time are now ministers and so on and running the country. So, you know, didn't call that one right. I came back and, I was looking for a job, you know, because I'm a Libyan with a PhD in nuclear physics. No way I can go to the States. Soviet Union had collapsed a few years before that. I was a mediocre sort of researcher, graduated with a PhD, but nothing, you know, to go and say, I did this. You know, I worked on skirmions, which was not even a current problem. And so I started to get in debt and stuff, and I needed a job. I really didn't want to leave physics. So I used to go to the faculty club because I was broke, and it's the only place I could eat on credit. And so I, you know, hung out there and met some economics professor who was raving how Robert Lucas could win the Nobel Prize for his theory of rational expectations in economics, and that economies can blow up for internal reasons and so on. So I said, I can put some equations to that. And we were talking about self-organized criticality. So I started to shoehorn some nonlinear dynamics to his ideas. And before I knew it, I was standing at the Fields Institute talking about complex shocks in large shocks in complex economies and stuff like that. And in the hallway, I got a job at Scotia, managing market risk, you know. And at the time, the regulators, you know, were pushing the banks to go into this VAR thing, where you every night you have to compute what's the amount of loss that you're likely to incur with a 99% probability. They were having a hard time of it. And that was because they had a lot of complex derivatives, and they didn't know how to model them and so on. And they had a bunch of, a portfolio of these options called Bermudans, which are very complicated options. And they said it's an 80-variable problem and stuff like that. And I started looking at it, and it turned out to be really there's only two variables that matter. The problem was superficially difficult because it had a saddle point. And even though you're really solving a two-dimensional problem, there was no minimum. And so it was unstable numerically. But they had 80 variables to look at. And so I quickly fixed that. And they were, wow, we make you boss of these people. You know, and so that was, you know, how I ended up managing people at Scotia. And mind you, 9 months before that, I did not have a bank account, didn't know what a bond was. So you can see that the judgment of these banks of who physicists are, what they can do, was very poor. Because I had no idea what the business of the bank was. I really didn't. That's an important thing. If I was to give people advice, always know what it is that people want that you're working for. Because, you know, at the time, they really loved what I did, not because they were fascinated by the theory or that it was such a great thing. It solved the problem that the regulator was on, and that's all they cared about. So anyway, I ended up hiring about 10 or 12 at some time physics PhDs from Bell Labs and Niels Bohr and Princeton and whatnot, and hired a lot of my friends. And we had a great time, rolled in whenever. The bank just was happy that we were taking care of this bomb thing that they called, you know, market risk, that they didn't really understand and half understood what we were talking about. And we all sort of, you know, enjoyed our time. It was a good time. And had babies and all that. It was nice. And then I sort of got a little tired of that, and I got involved into the bank's business with hedge funds, which is another thing they got into, and structured finance, all that stuff that blew up in 2008. I got curious about that, and I wanted to come closer to the business side of things. And that was very, very interesting. You know, I got involved in that for a few years. But then I had to quit the bank because I don't have to name names, but there was a major fraud that was in the news everywhere. Everybody heard about it. Well, that fraudulent individual came to the bank to borrow a lot of money. And when I sent my guys and reviewed the structure, we said, this looks really, really weird. It's very unorthodox. And this guy sits on the board and sits on this. And there's too much control. It's not an orthodox structure. They said, well, thank you, but, you know, every bank is dealing with this guy. Who are you to say no? You know, and it happened twice again. And I said, you know, what am I, just an issue popper? You know, I just tell you what I think, and then you decide whatever. That's, you know, you're not in control of your destiny. You're just a cog, as John earlier today. it was not satisfying, and basically I had destroyed my career at the bank by refusing to sign these things. And I quit, and I joined a hedge fund, which was the best thing that I could have ever done. And it's a small company, about 40 people now. We manage 2 billion of people's money, and we take 2% if we lose money, and we take 20% of the profits. And we make money for people. And we do it the easy way. If there's an easy way to make money, we actually do it and we understand it. And if there isn't an easy way to make money, we sit on the cash, and if people want to take their money out, they take it out. It's a very different proposition altogether. Everybody's a partner, but you know, you work hard, you know, but you're making a real difference because it's a small company and it's much more grounded. So I think that's a, you know, cursory look.
Okay, thanks, Abdallah. So, Neil?
Well, I certainly didn't endure any of the hardships that Abdullah did. but yeah, so, right, I was a physicist. I did my PhD at McGill as a string theorist, primarily working with Rob Myers, who I'm sure you all know. I pretty much followed the standard route. I had a postdoc at MIT, and I went and worked there. I basically finished the postdoc. I had another postdoc lined up at the University of Chicago to start, and that would have been in 2004. And somewhere in between getting to MIT and getting the offer for the next postdoc, I decided this just wasn't what I wanted to do. It was partly not enjoying research and string theory anymore. It was partly the academic lifestyle. It would be hard for me to quantify exactly what it was, but I wasn't enjoying it. So I thought I would look elsewhere. And for me, and I think most physicists these days either know of somebody, or either know somebody directly, or know somebody who knows somebody, who ended up in the financial industry. And for me, the finance was always this thing that was out there, and it was kind of the analogy I use. It was kind of like the emergency exit in a movie theater. I always knew it was there. I felt really somehow knew it was good that it was there, but I'd never actually opened the door and gone through it to see what was on the other side. I had no idea what I was really getting into. But it served the purpose as sort of an escape valve. Anyway, I started looking around, and there's a whole wide range. The first thing I learned is finance is a huge multidisciplinary field. And even people who have the same training, say myself, I know people who are string theorists that are in finance now that do things that are completely so radically different from what I'm doing that we can't even talk to each other except for, you know, very basic stuff. So I decided I was going to go for it, and then I started, you know, talking to people, finding out what that entailed. And I think I came across the first thing that I think most physicists are, certainly not all, but certainly most, I think, physicists come across. If they start Googling around for finance, physics type things, you come across very quickly with something called the Black-Scholes equation, derivative stock options. And the reason many physicists start out their career in New York or London primarily, and increasingly today Hong Kong, sitting on trading desks, trading or pricing up or derivatives, is because this thing called the Black-Scholes equation, or the Black-Scholes differential equation, is something that we all know and love from undergraduate called the heat equation. But it's written in a particularly obnoxious coordinate system from a physicist's point of view. It makes a lot of sense in finance, but it's a partial differential equation, first order in time. It's not that complicated. What makes it complicated, and the reason physicists were historically, and I'm talking the 70s and 80s now, involved in the options markets, was because the boundary conditions that are relevant for financial derivatives are pretty terrible. They're not amenable to any such thing as an analytic solution, and physicists know how, if they know how to do anything, they know how to numerically integrate partial differential equations, okay? And that's really what physicists were doing in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. They were there because they were one of the few people who knew how to do this. They could program computers, they knew the math. And I guess there was things like in the early 90s, or whenever it was, the late 80s, the SCC got canceled in Texas, and there's a whole bunch of unemployed physicists looking for places to employ their talents. Anyway, so So I was aware of all this, or I quickly became aware of all it. I went and bought on Amazon all the basic textbooks you could find that talked about derivatives from a theoretical standpoint. I read them. I started talking to people who, anyone I could find who knew something about finance or might know something about finance. And I eventually got in touch with a former string theorist. He was a string theorist from the pre-duality era, so in the 80s. And he had a job at the firm I work at now. And he made me a deal. It's the most interesting barter exchange I've ever engaged in. The deal was that he would give me 10 contacts from his Rolodex, effectively, every week, in exchange for remedial lectures on D-brains. It's a true story. He showed up every week in my office on Thursday, and on my blackboard in my office at MIT, I was showing him D-brains, T-duality, ADS, CFT. So, he's a very good friend of mine today, and he ended up introducing me to the people who first hired me, which is this bank called State Street, which is a big-ish U.S. bank, and I was doing quantitative research for them, nothing to do with derivatives, as it turns out. So in that sense, my path is a little bit non-standard for physicists into finance. I'm by no means an outlier, but a little bit non-standard. And I was doing things mostly around optimization, something called asset allocation, portfolio construction type stuff. A lot of the people out there, the big investors, the institutional investors, by which I mean pension plans, endowments, foundations, extremely wealthy individuals in some cases, the problem they're trying to solve is to put assets in stocks or bonds or commodities or to allocate to what's called alternative assets, which could be anything like real estate or various other things. My group at State Street spent a lot of time trying to build quantitative techniques and risk management tools. This concept that he mentioned called VAR or value at risk was something we spent a lot of time looking at the time. And that ultimately wasn't a terribly satisfying role for me. Basically, I was doing first or second year undergraduate math with models that really didn't capture the essence of things, and then going off and talking to State Street's clients about how wonderful this was and how their portfolios would be safe because I calculated this thing to the third decimal place, blah, blah, blah. I'm not kidding. So I was flying all over the world. It seemed very glamorous. I'd be talking in Tokyo, and then I'd be in Hong Kong the next day, and then I'd be in London. And for a while, it was kind of fun. I'll admit, it was a very different lifestyle from that of a physicist, but it was kind of soul-destroying. After a while, office towers, taxis, hotels, and airports, week on week on week is just not really a fun way to live your life. Anyway, this friend of mine that originally got me into the business, who at that point I was questioning my friendship with, he actually brought me over to the firm I work at now, which is a very different beast than where I was previously. Where I work now is what's typically called an asset management company, not terribly different from what Abdul is doing, although they're probably doing slightly more aggressive things. Our clients are, again, pension plans. So think big teachers' pension plans, say here in Ontario, not to name any names. Big Ivy League endowments in the U.S. are our client. Foundations, so things like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Anybody who has large pools of assets to manage typically outsources the day-to-day managing of those assets. And so we're one of a very large number of global firms that are providing that service. So that's where I work. Our firm manages about $100 billion U.S. globally, which sounds like a huge sum of money, and it is. But this isn't people's, like individual rich people's money. This is institutions. This is the retirement system of the Texas teachers, right? Or New York State teachers, or Ontario teachers, or the Caisse de dépôt in Quebec. These are huge pools of your money, in some sense, and we're being hired to manage this. And what we're doing, primarily my firm, is a very quantitative approach to this. It's not the super high-frequency trading that you might read about in the newspapers. You know, like 2 weeks ago, a Twitter feed got hacked, and all of a sudden the market crashed because computers were trading on that information. I'm not doing that, but there are lots of physicists who are doing that. So it's not as though it's not as though physicists are doing uniform, playing the same role everywhere. But what we're doing primarily is sucking in all the data we can on every single, I work on stocks, sorry, I should have said that, almost exclusively stocks and things related to stocks, like stock options and futures on indices and things. But we suck in all the data we can possibly bring in, everything from the earnings from last quarter, how much debt the company's carrying, the number of employees at the company, to the price data. What was the tick-by-tick price of Apple or BlackBerry going up, you know, on a minute, second by second, or millisecond by millisecond basis? Sorry,
or down. Down.
Yeah. Apple's been down a lot too. But so we're pulling in all that data, and our job, and I'm not going to go into the details, but not because it's super top secret or anything. So I don't want to take up all the time. We basically build a black box in some sense. The data comes in, and we do several things, depending on the type of data. For the higher frequency stuff, we're looking at statistical algorithms, patterns in the data, and trying to figure out who's trading and why, and how we can position our portfolio, because we have to execute trades. We have all the data we're bringing in on the fundamental side, the earning statements, all that kind of stuff, is very slow moving. In the U.S. and the Canada, it's quarter by quarter. Some parts of the world, you only get data every 6 months on companies' overall health. So this is very slow-moving data. And so what we're doing is we're bringing the slow-moving data. We're trying to figure out the best places to put our clients' money. And then we have the higher frequency data to try and help us figure out, when we have to make the trades, how to best do that. And so all of this is done with, let's call them algorithms, quantitative type algorithms. And it can be everything from some fairly sophisticated stochastic type calculus stuff to some very, very simple, you know, statistics 101 regression analysis. And the real overriding thing behind it is that none of the models that you read about in textbooks, including this Black-Scholes equation I mentioned at the beginning, really describe reality at all. At best, I was using this analogy at lunch, they're like the phi to the four theory in field theory. Okay, most of the essential elements are there. You can learn about it. You learn about some of the basic dynamics, but ultimately, it has zero. There's no description of reality that it corresponds to, and so what we spend most of our time doing is trying to figure out what rules of thumbs and heuristics to use and to plug the gaps. And it's not like there's some QCD or standard model out there that really is the right theory. That, you know, if you know phi to the four theory. You can kind of get there, right? There is no standard model. There is no grand unified theory. And so you spend most of your time trying to figure out where the assumptions go wrong, because where the assumptions go wrong is either a trading opportunity, although chances are someone already found it first and it's gone, or more likely it's just a big risk. There's a hole in the model. You're trying to hedge your positions and things like that, and you can't do it all of a sudden. Because the theory says I can trade continuously, and if I trade continuously, I'll be perfectly hedged. Well, fact of the matter is you can't. Transaction costs, the amount it costs to trade, people at Goldman Sachs, RBC, whatever, they take a cut of every trade you do. Those transaction costs are order one. They're not perturbations. They're real, and they're the difference between making a lot of money and you giving the bank a lot of money that you're trading with. So anyway, that's the stuff that's sort of what I do now. I run a group that does all the research and builds all those models within my firm. So I've got a couple of employees in London, most of my team's in Boston, most of our firm's investment decisions are based on the models that my team builds for stocks. There's an equivalent team that does the bonds and the currencies. And we build the models. Most of the people on my team are PhDs. Some are in physics, computer science, engineering. I have some non-PhDs as well, just people who are, you know, did an undergraduate in engineering, did an MBA, and they're really smart, and they're quantitatively inclined. They like finance. So it's a pretty broad mix of people that work on this, and that's more or less what I do every day. I'm sure there'll be questions, so.
Okay, thanks, Neil. All right.
Great. So I guess I will bore some of the people in the audience, because some of you know the path that I took to get to Canopy Labs. But let's see, where do I start? I did my PhD here at PI and Waterloo, and I defended my thesis in May 2012, so May last year. However, 4 or 5 months before that, I had already decided that I wanted to look for other opportunities. And the first thing that I did actually was looking up who were one of my supervisors' former students. So, and that's how I got in touch with you. I don't know if you remember this. I meant to tell you before we started. Yes. But so what I did is literally I went to Inspire. I looked up Rob Myers, who was one of my PhD advisors. The other one was Pedro. And I clicked to see who his former students were. And that's how I found Neil. Then I Googled him. And I actually Googled every single one of his former students to see what they were up to, because I was sure that at least half of them would be doing something else, right? I mean, they were all string theories, so that was a given. So I got in. I made a short list of former students of Rob. And I got in touch with them by email. I Googled their names. I found out that Neil was working at GMO. And actually, Neil, I think, was the only one who replied to my email. My shortlist had four people, I think. And you were the only one. Yes. And Neil was kind enough to actually hop on a call with me. And he walked me through some textbooks that I could read to get familiar with finance terms and all this. So yeah, that was the first thing that I did. And I did that because initially my idea was to either go into finance or into consulting, management consulting, which are the two usual paths that people with PhDs in physics or PhDs in a quantitative field take. So I was in the process of applying to investment banks when Jonathan Hackett, who some of you might know, put me in touch with who is now my co-founder at Canopy Labs. And Jonathan Hackett was a former student of Lee Smalling here at PI, and he's now a consultant at BCG, the Boston Consulting Group. So he put me in touch with Wojciech, who was quitting McKinsey to start Canopy Labs. And Canopy Labs is a predictive customer analytics company. And what that means is that we are developing a platform to which small and medium-sized businesses will be able to upload their customer data, all the customer data that they have. It can be transactional data, it can be email data, unstructured data, anything that you can think of. They will upload it, or they actually upload it to the platform nowadays. The platform runs algorithms, machine learning, data mining algorithms on the data. And we tell the company things such as whether or not a customer is likely to stop buying from them in the future, how much is a customer likely to spend with a company. We also have a recommendation engine. So if we have product level information, we also tell the company, the next time you reach out to this person, you should be offering these products, and so on. So that was the vision that Wojciech had for the company. And we met here at PI in February last year, so 3 months before I defended my thesis. We got along, and we decided to keep in touch. And a month later, we decided to work together. So I guess he's a very good salesman. So I was sold on the idea, and yeah, that's how we decided to start to work together. It was March last year. A week after we decided that we were gonna do this together, we applied to Y Combinator, which is a startup incubator program in Mountain View in Silicon Valley. So we applied. We were lucky enough to get in. And we spent the summer of 2012 down in the valley. And you can think of Y Combinator as boot camp, basically, for early stage companies. You spend the 3 months working from Monday to Sunday, literally 15 hours, 16 hours a day, working on your product, on your company, to make it grow as much as you can in that period. And by the end of the 3 months, one of the big advantages of Y Combinator is that it gives you access to the elite investors in the Valley, right? And actually in the US in general. So at the end of the 3 months, there is demo day in which all the companies of the Y Combinator class pitch their company in front of 500 investors, and which included Ashton Kutcher, by the way, last year. You pitch your company, and in the 2 months after the demo day, you usually close your seed round. And we were lucky enough that so BDC of Canada and Peter Thiel's Valar Ventures Fund. Peter Thiel was one of the founders of PayPal. Invested in us, and they gave us $1.5 million to as a seed round to make the company grow. So we closed the round in October last year. We were already back in Toronto. We decided to come back to Canada for various reasons. One of them is that $1.5 million will last you approximately 6 or 8 months more here than it would in the Valley. And the talent pool in Toronto and Waterloo is just as good as the one in the Valley. So we decided to come back here. At that point, it was still the two of us. Nowadays, we are 5 full-time employees. We have 3 co-op students. We have 5 paying customers. And we are working as hard as ever to make the company grow. So as you can see, my path was very different. I didn't end up doing finance. I didn't end up doing management consulting. I ended up, I guess, starting a company from the ground up. And I'm actually very, very happy that things turned out that way. I think because of how I am in particular, I enjoy this type of work probably more than I would enjoy working for a huge corporation. It's very, very exciting to build something from nothing, basically, right? And see how people start using it, the feedback that they give you, you iterate on it, and so on. It's super, super exciting. In terms, they also asked me, I think, Diana, in the document that she sent to us, they asked us to talk about what are the skills that we think are easily transferable from physics or from a PhD in physics to the industry where we work. And in my case, I would say, in my personal case, my willingness to learn pretty much anything that I'm interested in. When I joined Canopy Labs, Wojciech was looking for someone who knew how to code in Java, for example. And I had never coded in Java before. But in the month between when we met and we decided to work together, I coded in Java a lot, and so I proved to him that I was able to learn it quickly and that I was going to be able to be productive for the company, which played a huge factor, was a huge factor in his decision to work with me. Paying a lot of attention to detail as well, I find that has been very helpful for me. And also, I'm very practically oriented. So not getting bogged down in like very little details when you work in the real world is also very, I found that has helped me a lot. But yeah, I guess you will have questions afterwards. So I'll be happy to answer that.
Actually, that's a great lead-in. So why don't the two of you maybe comment on some of the skills you thought were most transferable or the things you feel like you really gained from academia that helped you and be successful in your careers? We'll start with Nima. Yeah. Sure. Start with you and then we'll...
Okay. The most transferable skills were by far and away the hardest ones to quantify. And it's the stuff that anybody who does a PhD is confronted with. You have to be able to comfortable. At some point, I learned how to sit down and solve a problem that there wasn't an answer to, right? There wasn't an existing answer to. You can't look it up in a textbook. Your advisor presumably didn't give you a problem to work on that's already been solved. And the ability to organize your thoughts, collect the information you need, learn new things, right? I mean, oftentimes you have to go learn a new, if you're a string theorist, go learn something about algebra, geometry that you would never have otherwise had to learn. And so the mental flexibility and versatility that you pick up as a graduate student, particularly in physics, but in lots of quantitative fields, and the ability to be self-directed, right? To figure out, you've learned somewhere along the way you've learned to have good taste, I call it, in what to pursue and what not to pursue. And obviously, you don't always get that right. But those are the skills that were the most useful for me. I mean, there is no way that I use algebraic geometry today in finance, okay? I don't use, fermionic string theories, right? It's not relevant. The stuff that I didn't know that I needed to learn very quickly, and this is particularly relevant for string theorists, and you all already hit on it, it's very difficult to go out there in the real world in quantitative problems if you're not a good programmer.
Yes.
Right? And it's going to be, you can't go out and learn all programming languages, obviously. But so he picked up Java. A lot of physicists that end up in the banks on Wall Street, the weapon of choice is C++, typically, but not always. I currently use a much less complicated language called MATLAB. Is primarily what we use, but we have a fair bit of Java lying around, and an ability to plug and play and deal with various APIs from different packages, SQL databases, so things like Oracle or MySQL, absolutely crucial. I've written tens of thousands of lines of SQL code in the last 5 years. And I knew none of that when I left. I mean, what would you ever do that in string theory with, right? I mean, at least most of the string theorists I know sneered at writing computer code. if it wasn't a conserved quantity in some integral, there was no point in paying attention to it. You didn't actually calculate the integral. That's my long-winded answer to the question.
It's a very, very diverse field. So it has demands for all sorts of skills. You can be... I've seen situations where there are people who are very bad coders, actually, quite weird, and so on, and they're actually doing some important role for a bank. So, for instance, in large quant groups in the banks, they need a bottleneck breaker guy on the analytical problems. And this guy is usually, or girl, is usually very analytically oriented and fairly introverted and doesn't care about, practical problems in general. They're rarer, much, much rarer, but they do need them and they do have them. The ones that are properly structured actually have them. So you're right in saying it's very difficult to do it without programming, but there are niche roles. That you can find where you can be useful without programming, for instance. In my case, I don't have a great skill of any kind, but the skill that served me the most was knowing how to deal with people, and mostly really trying to think hard about what do these people want, what are their interests? And so knowing who's around me and knowing what does my boss really care about and what do my colleagues care about and so on, as opposed to, I like this kind of work or I like that, that tended to, translate into something beneficiary for me in the longer run.
So maybe for Neil, when you were exploring your options, the end of your postdoc at MIT, were you only looking into finance, or did you look at a range of options, or how was it for you?
No, so I looked at, and he already hit on it. I looked at the two most common directions. Actually, there's three: management consulting, finance, and software. Mm-hmm. Companies, and given that I didn't know how to code anything, software companies was off the table. And so I looked at management consulting and finance. And the great thing about being in Boston and sort of in the MIT-Harvard nexus that exists in Cambridge, all these firms, whether they're finance firms or management consultancies, they do massive amounts of recruiting. They have recruiting drives just for undergraduates. They have recruiting drives just for post-grad students. They have recruiting drives just for MBA students. And so I kind of just, it's a menu of, you know, where you want to show up and listen to what they have to say. So I went to a bunch of these things. I went to some presentations by the Boston Consulting Group, BCG. I went to a McKinsey event. And I very quickly concluded that just wasn't for me. It could be very interesting work. I know people who are very happy doing it. I'm very glad I didn't choose to do it, but I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have succeeded at it. It's just not my my skill set. But then finance sort of became the default option. And and like I say, the first place I ended up was fine. I learned some important stuff. But at the end of the day, it wasn't the right thing. I think that's an important thing, actually, while we're on the topic. The likelihood that you're going to walk through my proverbial exit door, emergency exit, and land in the place that's the best for you in a field where you've had no experience whatsoever is very low. The vast majority of people who I know in the financial industry who are very happy doing what they're doing, which I would classify myself as that today, took one or two false steps trying to figure out what's going on in that industry.
Just two?
Well, I only took one, so I got lucky. I won the lottery, right? But that's an important thing to remember, because it's a very big industry globally. It's also very opaque. It's not obvious what all these people are doing inside of these big banks or inside these hedge funds or whatever. And so it's very difficult for you to know ahead of time whether you're going to like the actual work you're doing. Another important thing is you're not going to like a lot of the people. Okay, Gordon Gekko is alive and well. Okay, those people exist, they are nasty, and they do use phrases like rip your eyeballs out, okay? And they're to be avoided, right? But they exist, there's whole firms that only are populated by those people, right? So the likelihood of a physicist getting hired by one of those firms is pretty low, so your risk's not that great. But my only point being that it's sort of this big, no holds barred, the gloves are off industry. So it's important, if you're going to do it, to be very careful, talk to as many people as possible. And if a firm wants to make you an offer, that can be a great thing. It's very, you know, exciting for someone to call you up and offer you a job for, you know, X amount of dollars, and you're going to get to go to London or Tokyo or whatever the heck it is. Call around. Find out as much as you can about this firm. Find out what the reputation is on the street about this firm. Call headhunters. Find out what the reputation is amongst the recruiters out there. Because there's a lot of, you know, miserable places to work, and it's hard to extract yourself, right? You took all this effort into getting a job. It's a full-time job looking for a job, and so it's gonna be very difficult to get out of it once you're there. And I'm not trying to make it. I think that's probably true anywhere. I mean, finance isn't unique in that regard, but it is something to be aware of. So I guess my advice is ask lots of questions to as many people as you can get a hold of.
Maybe I'll just ask one more question, then we'll open up the floor. So Abdallah, did you have any specific people during this time when you were starving, eating on credit, you know, at the faculty club?
I wasn't starving, I was just eating on credit.
Okay. That kind of pointed you in the direction that you went, or was this something that you kind of more or less came to on your own?
When I was at McMaster, I was very, very well taken care of. I had mentors all around me, one of which was John, who made sure that I was, you know, well integrated and happy and doing what I wanted to do, and also nudging me on my way out. And when I went and tried to make it work out in Libya, and it didn't work out, they literally rescued me. So because Canada refused to grant me a visa. And so they wrote to Ottawa on my behalf, and they said, we want this guy as a visiting scientist. And they said, nope, declined. And so McMaster wrote again to Ottawa saying, this is a distinguished visiting scientist, you know. And so they finally had to yield. And just to take the revenge at me, the visa officer granted me the visa, putting quotation marks around distinguished. You know, so I had that thing at the bar at McMaster when I came back, showing it to everybody, which was great. but so that was a great environment, and it's a It's an environment that I took as a model for how a community or a group of people really should work. It was a lot of open-minded people who kept an eye on what the students are doing, how are they developing, and if you didn't play by the rules, you didn't get some authoritarian punishment and stuff like that. And for me, the physics department is the model for how the world should really run for many, many reasons. It's a relaxed and happy place. And it's very, very effective and productive. What more can you ask? So that was a very important support that I got there. At the bank, I was literally making career mistakes all the time. I was making bad turn after bad turn after bad turn, and nobody was really mentoring me and telling me, Abdallah, you are really... Until I just basically, you know... Funny enough, some of my mistakes ended up being promotions. Until I ran into like some serious issues and ended up outside the bank. Where I work now, you know, the folks that I work with are a nice supportive environment because they kind of said, "Oh, Abdallah, you used to a bank. Okay, this is just a bunch of guys. And just relax. Just we're all partners." And it took me a while to get that, but they allowed me the time to do that. So that I think is a very a good thing. It really I think what he was saying is very, very important, and that is you have to really it's just small communities or groups of people that you're going to be joining, and you have to be very, very careful who you're joining. Mind you, if you're starting out, it doesn't really matter so much who you're joining because you don't have a lot to lose by leaving. You know, just don't get stuck in a place where you're not happy, I think is more important. Start anywhere and then you can walk away because you don't have much to lose. You're just starting out. But don't settle in. There's a lot of small groups that sort of the world starts to feel like it stops at the walls, and there's lots of them in the banks, and there's lots of physicists in them, and I got stuck in some of those, and so on. If it doesn't feel right, just walk. You'll be better off.
You know. By the way, I wanted to expand on something that I, before we start with questions, to expand on something that I touched on earlier, which is if I had to give one piece of advice to all of you, it would be that you should really leverage your personal network if you're trying to find a job outside of academia. It sounds like in Neil's case, it was also that's also what got you your first job, right? And it was also the same with me. And I would say that's true for most of the physicists that I know that made the transition to another industry. So yeah, don't be afraid to just get in touch with people that maybe were not your friends, but you just... Yeah. Met at a conference, or you met while you were visiting, or they were visiting PI in this case.
Absolutely.
And that will get you much, much farther than simply submitting your resume through investment bank, through an investment website. Yeah. That will almost never work.
I mean, I'll echo that in spades. When I was a physicist, I don't mean maybe people view it differently. I certainly used to think of networking and anything that might smell of an MBA student. I used to think of that as a four-letter word, you know, whatever. At the end of the day, the only thing that ever worked for me and it was calling people. I literally called anyone who I knew, you know, ex-husbands of my girlfriend's friend kind of thing. I mean, no, I'm not kidding. Right? And his experience with sending out emails was similar to mine. I'm glad I answered his email, but most people didn't respond to my emails. Or I'd talk to people on the phone who were ex-physicists or mathematicians, and they'd say, so what can you offer me? And I'd say, well, I'm just learning C++, and I know a little bit of stochastic calculus. And he goes, I need a lot of C++, a lot of stochastic calculus. Don't waste my time. Click. I'm like, really? But you're going to, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a different world out there outside of academia. It's not bad or good. It's just, it requires a little bit of perseverance and a certain amount of brashness, you know, just go for it. You know, and different personalities deal with that in different ways.
And if you're not lucky and you didn't have friends and connections, as I did at the time, I walked into RBC's Mississauga office, not knowing the difference between buildings. I was volunteering to work at Risk Lab because I thought that'll get me something. And frustrated, coming out, I see RBC on this big building, and I walk into the building and I say, "My name is Abdallah. I'm a nuclear physicist from Libya, and I want to switch to finance." The guy looks at me and goes, "Wait a minute." Goes in and comes back with a piece of paper. He says, "Here's a bunch of traders' names. They're on Bay Street. We don't do that stuff here." And so,
but there's contacts right there. Yeah.
That's great. You know. I like it. Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, so we'll open the floor up for questions now.
Good, we'll drink some wine.
Sure, John, get us started.
So I was struck, Neil and Abdallah both, started one place and then quickly found the place that they were, not quickly, but eventually found the place that they were happy to be. On the other hand, Jorge is on his first startup.
Yeah.
And you probably learned about this in boot camp, what the probability of success is like in startups.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder if you learned from people who had had that experience, you know, how things go. In other words, when they start something and it just flops, but then frequently they just go on someplace else, and sooner or later, if they're lucky, things work. Did you talk to people about that, or do you have?
I did. Yes. Actually, some of the founders of the companies that were in my class in Y Combinator were serial entrepreneurs. So they had co-founded a handful of startups even before starting the one that they were in Y Combinator with. And so that's one type of entrepreneur, I would say, the serial type of entrepreneur. They start a company, it doesn't work out, they start the next one, and that's how they live. On the other hand, there is another type of entrepreneur, which is the one that works in a couple of startups, maybe, or even only one. Doesn't work out, he realizes that he wants to do something else, but the skills that you learn when you join a startup, especially if it's a very early stage startup, are the type of skills that big corporations look for in managers. When they're looking for managers or even junior management, positions, they look for people, or they're especially interested, I would say, in people that have started a company, that have gone through the process of trying to make it grow and so on. So,
I think the best thing that can happen to anybody coming out of physics is getting Jorge's kind of starting experience, because even failure is an asset there.
Yeah.
And the being part of a business and being really, really connected to the actual thing as opposed to being some overhead department is a far more satisfying experience.
Yes.
At least you'll be having fun and enjoying yourself.
Yes.
So I kind of feel like I should probably, I've been pretty bad on, or both of us have been pretty mean to the big banks. there are people that, a very good friend of mine in grad school, at McGill, he went and did a postdoc after he finished, and then I'd already left to work at State Street. But he contacted me while I was at State Street, said, "You know what? I'm giving up. I want to go into finance or look into it." And so I put him in touch with a few people. One of the recruiters that I'd worked with in the past, who hadn't turned up anything for me, but I thought was a good guy, I put him in touch with, and he's now he now works at Goldman Sachs in New York, which is, it's the evil empire, if there was an evil empire, right? But he's been incredibly successful. He's the head quantitative person on their what's called the electronic market making desk for equity derivatives. That desk alone makes about $250 or $300 million in revenue for Goldman Sachs every year. And he's one of the top two people in that entire business line for Goldman Sachs. He's done very well for himself. He's not an aggressive guy. He's one of the most mild-mannered people you'd ever meet. It wasn't like I actually still think of him as a physicist, not as a finance guy. Good friend of mine. So it's not as though it's uniquely a bad place, but they are ultra competitive. And you know, he landed in a very good group, right? He landed in a group of people that, with his mentors, the guy that started that group, who's now a very senior person inside Goldman Sachs, was a very good teacher and mentored my friend, and he learned, and he's done great work. He's happy, as far as I know. So it's not as less impossible, by any stretch of the imagination. So I feel like I should probably give both sides of it. But.
And if you land in a group of nice people, the fact that they work in a bank is not as important to you, because you'll be shielded. It's when you advance that you become more in touch with the bank and the bureaucracy and all that stuff that
politics.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I often describe to some of the people that are sort of more junior that work for me, but I envision being in management roles one day, is my main job. I mean, aside from working on the models with these people and supervising it, is to shield them from what they call the organizational rain. I basically carry the umbrella around, making sure that all the politics, all the stuff going on amongst other senior people in the firm, myself included, doesn't impact their ability to get work done. It's not a very thing. It largely goes unrecognized. If I'm doing my job well, no one knows I'm doing it. Yeah. If I'm not doing my job well, the people that work for me are going to be very unhappy, because they're going to be stuck and mired in weird political situations that they're not there. I mean, they're not either not ready from the just how, you know, ready to deal with, because they haven't been around the firm long enough, but they don't want to deal with it in most cases. So it's important when you're talking to someone who's going to be your boss, find out how they, you can't ask them that question directly, like, are you going to, shield me from all the nonsense? But get a sense if that's the kind of person that you're going to be working for. Get a sense if they're going to be a good mentor or not.
Yeah.
And that's really important, because that can, not only will, if they're good mentors, will they propel your, their job is to propel your career forward. You're also going to learn an awful lot, and you're going to have a lot more fun doing it.
Questions? More questions?
Was always this kind of exit door, was always the right factor. So, but do you think that that's still going to be true in the next few years, or are the companies now, the market is market getting saturated with PhDs or PhDs or
So, yes, I think it will always be there. I think it's not going to be this, the jobs that are going to need doing 5 years from now aren't the jobs that were needed doing 5 years ago. It's an evolving dynamic situation. But one of the things, the biggest consumer of technology, the stuff that Oracle and Cisco and whoever make, is the financial industry, right? Yeah. So, and it's all about data, technology, under the covers. So there's an ever-increasing demand for people with quantitative skills. Now, the roles that they play 5-10 years from now may be different than the ones that they're playing today. But I find increasingly there are lots and lots of firms like my firm's one of them, and my competitors, that get by on very few MBAs, right? Our lifeblood is people who have problem-solving skills, people who are quantitatively oriented, and they can write code. We don't have this, a lot of these successful firms these days, and there's exceptions. There's people that are doing the MBA thing, and they're doing it well, and they're successful. But there's more and more firms that are primarily focused on good problem solvers, cooperative sort of collaborative projects, where it's all about teamwork, almost a startup mentality. Mm-hmm. And my firm has, this is probably all new to you guys. We have $100 billion under management, which is an astronomically large number. We only have 500 employees globally, right? And 250 of them are IT, right? Another 100 are salespeople and client relations people. So when you get down to it, there's about 100 people that are sort of sitting in a seat similar to my, or doing similar things to me. And we're the ones driving the firm. So I don't see that abating, I guess, is the short answer. The roles that you'll play will just evolve with technology, will evolve with however, I don't know what's going to happen in the markets over the next 20 years. But it's been an ever-increasing march. And the things you'll see will be the cyclical variations When I got into the business, actually, one of the guys that tried to discourage me was he was the guy that hung up the phone on me. He was also saying that this is in 2003, it was a recession in the U.S. After the tech bubble and all that. He said, there's no jobs. The market sucks. I mean, the guy was the emotional basket case, right? But and you'll see these cyclical variations post 2008 and going on today. The big banks are shedding jobs. There's layoffs all the time, and a lot of those jobs are quantitative people. But the cycle will turn. Yeah. And as an overall trend through the financial industry, I really don't see it abating at all. I mean, there's more need for these jobs. And in fact, after Silicon Valley, the financial industry is the next in line complaining to the U.S. government about its ridiculous immigration policies around H-1B visas. Because we need people. We can't get enough people with the right qualifications. Mm-hmm. And so I just don't see that going away.
I mean, making money will always involve solving new problems. Because if the solution right. is well known, everybody does it, and there's no chance to make money with it. And so you'll always find innovation going towards solving newer problems where there's a challenge. And at this stage, it's more about technology and how fast you do things and so on. What got us into 2008 and that big blow up was about how to structure really complicated derivatives. Before that, it was actually derivatives themselves and portfolios of them. Before that, it was options and so on. So there's an ever increasing sort of a never receding frontier, that you'll need people to look at new problems.
Any other questions?
I'm just wondering, say in the job market, and say if you want to hire someone, how would you prefer a physics student other than some, say, master of ed, financial engineering, stuff like that? It seems like the majority of my friends in my class, they all went to do this financial engineering, economics, finance.
Yeah.
I mean, compare with them, so.
That's going to vary from person to person, from firm to firm. Mm-hmm. I personally, I've had a very poor experience with people coming through these masters of financial economics. And this is a controversial statement, I'll throw it out there right now, but I've had very poor success, with one notable exception, with people with PhDs in finance. I find physicists, computer scientists, mathematicians to be far, far better at problem solving and understanding, being this mental agility. I mean, I could just be completely biased on that. But that has been my experience. And some firms there are firms, especially around Boston, because Boston has the MIT Sloan Business School and the Harvard Business School, which is full of these quantitative finance people. And all the professors at HBS and Sloan also run hedge funds on the side. And they are obsessed. They will not hire a physicist. They think physicists are crazy, idiots, wouldn't understand what a regression was if it's to save their life. So I mean, it depends who you're talking to. If I don't look at resumes from those masters of engineering. I mean, I look at them, but I am particularly interested. But the one problem is, though, I also tend to like to have people who have gone to work if they're a physicist, they've gone to work for a bank for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. They've sat there on a trading desk, and seen something about the markets. It doesn't have to be the markets I'm particularly interested in, but. They've had that experience. It's something I tend to look for, not exclusively, but anyway, it's varied. I mean, you may have a different.
At the end of the day, with a quantitative degree, you're going to be able to get a job in finance. It's really not hard. To get an entry level job, it's not hard. It's how you navigate from there.
Yeah.
And how you navigate from there really depends on how well suited you are to the problem that you're working on. And most physicists, I find, are well suited to finance.
Okay, other questions? Maybe we take one or two more before we go down for wine and cheese.
Period
education, how do you compare that to those who don't stay in academia, and how sort of elusive was that factor for any of you?
How happy are these people?
It's important.
Yeah. If you're working hard on a problem that you love, and you wake up in the morning and you want to work on it, and you work on it at night because you're fascinated by it, and you can't stop thinking about it, don't go to finance. You are exactly where you should be. You know, so the hard work of the postdoc is a work of love. It's if they are doing it, you know, because of that, then you know that's the best job you can have, provided you can feed yourself. You know, which is not hard. We live in a rich country, so even unemployment is enough. So you know, if you go a step out in the workforce and you work for a corporation and so on, you're no longer pursuing your own dreams unless your dreams are to be a big shot manager or learn something and then do a business or something like that. You could, but in the greatest majority of the cases are just people trying to get a job, you know, to make some money. It's unless you're doing something like Jorge, which is something exciting and stuff like that. But the uncertainty there becomes this, you know, you're not in control of your destiny, you are not really important to the big scheme of things, and you'll have this angst. You know, every 2 or 3 years I have a big angst, and I change jobs or I do something, or I start to cause problems, you know, because it just gets too much. You know, you're just doing the same, you do the same thing, and it just becomes torturous, you know.
I was going to say, yeah, it really is a question of what you love. I mean, yeah, the postdoc. So, I think one of your questions was to what extent did that kind of the postdoc lifestyle feature into decision making? I mean, to me, yeah, a little bit. I was trying to solve a two-body problem, right? And my girlfriend followed me to Boston. She did a postdoc there because she didn't really want to continue academia, but she could get she got a postdoc at Brandeis. I was at MIT. That was great. She hated it after a year. She got a job in the software industry. She's very happy. By the time I decided I came back at home, she knew I wasn't terribly happy as a physicist at the time. But I came back home with an offer from Chicago, and she's like, "We're not moving to Chicago. I've got a great job I love, and you're not happy, right?" Yeah. And I was like, "Okay, good point." There was an element of that, but had I been in a situation where I was like I was as a grad student, and quite frankly, the first couple of years at MIT, up until midnight, grinding through calculations, reading papers, you know, if I'd been in that mode, I don't know where I'd be today. I probably wouldn't be sitting on this stage, and I probably wouldn't be in finance. But the other important thing with finance is you get inside these big banks, and yeah, it can just be a job. And some people I know, actually a very good friend of mine in Boston, who did his PhD in chemistry, worked for me at State Street, he's still there. He got to a level, and he doesn't want to get promoted. He goes in and tinkers and plays, and he lives a fun lifestyle. I mean, he goes out to dinner every night. He's not really that interested in getting promoted, and he's
probably
not going to get
a couple hundred grand or something.
Well, whatever, but yeah. And he's living a good lifestyle. He's happy. He's not that ambitious about his career. Now, me, on the other hand, I didn't want that. Right, so I did end up in a much smaller shop, and I am up till midnight occasionally, thinking through problems, trying to figure out how to do stuff. You know, this might sound like a bit of self-advertisement, but you know, I just wrote a paper on options and volatility that's like posted on our firm's website probably today or Monday or something like that. Like, it has nothing to do with actually trading. It's an academic curiosity that I wanted to play around with, but so I am able to do that. I'm in a position where I'm able to do that. My firm values that type of stuff, so it's out there. But the key thing is you want to put yourself in that situation, whether it's academia or in a corporation or in a small firm or in a startup. That's the trick.
Yes, and I also wanted to mention that if any of you guys is thinking about the startup world or the tech world, and if you have a great idea for a startup and you're passionate about it, you're probably in one of the best places or in one of the best cities in the world to pursue that. The startup community in Waterloo and in Toronto as well is one of the most vibrant ones currently. The University of Waterloo, I assume most of you are students at the University of Waterloo as well. The University of Waterloo has a couple of accelerator programs for startups, and some great, amazingly good startups have come out of them. So if you're interested in that, if you're passionate about something, just go there and talk to the people in charge, and they will definitely help you out.
Yeah, we take one last question.
There's one right here in the middle.
Could you just outline what like the average day at the office looks like?
I get in around 7:30 in the morning. I stay until 7 at night, typically, round numbers. I've got my team that works for me. We have some sort of an open floor plan, but some people have offices. What does the average day look like? So, you know, most of the guys on my team, girls as well, are we're either dealing with trading issues. So, you know, got computer terminals up, the stock market's moving, stuff's happening, we're trying to get trades out in the market. So there's a bit of a, sometimes it can be a bit hectic, depending on what's going on in the market. Most of the time, though, we have gigantic databases and people are sitting there doing research. They're thinking about, you know, how to mine through the data that we have available to find signals. They're reading academic papers in finance there's a whole bunch of practitioner type journals where people who work in the industry typically are writing up ideas, trying to read those, understand them. Does it apply to what we're doing? Why is it wrong? Is usually the approach we take. But there is a research element to it. Most people work less hours than I do, which is perfectly acceptable. I'm a bit OCD about certain things, so I just sit there and work too hard. But and it's a pretty collegial environment. It's not high stress. You know, it can be. We were talking at lunch about around the financial crisis in 2008. I'll be very brief, but it was, you know, that was terrifying, and terrifying in ways that I never want to live through again. Morgan Stanley, big U.S. investment bank, was basically the place we have to have a bank account somewhere, effectively. We have to put it, you know, we have a trading account. We put our clients' money there. It's our clients' money, but we do it on their behalf. Morgan Stanley was serving that function for us. Morgan Stanley almost went bankrupt. They owed us $3 billion. Okay.
And it's terrifying.
And it's terrifying because it's my client's money.
All his net worth is in his company.
Actually, yeah.
That's why it's terrifying.
Less so, but it's also terrifying because we have a fiduciary responsibility to our clients, meaning we're responsible. We've told them, we've held out for them, we have controls in place in case bad things happen. We're going to help them. Morgan Stanley is crashing. We're on the phone. We have a big relationship with Morgan Stanley. We're one of their bigger clients, and we had very senior people, our lawyers, their lawyers. I was in the room because I was responsible for one of the portfolios. You know, the Morgan Stanley stock keeps falling. Are you going bankrupt? Or are you not? Because if they go bankrupt, the fact that they owe us $3 billion sounds like it's their problem, right? It's actually our problem. They got it. We don't. Actually, they didn't have it. That was the part of the problem. But anyway, we long story short, we convinced them that they could actually wire us half the money, approximately. We opened up an account at another bank, effectively last minute checking account type thing. Had to get the money. It was really, you know, gum and... it was like MacGyver or whatever, duct tape and chewing gum and all that. But got the money into the account. The bank was called State Street, actually my former employer. Supposedly a very staid, conservative firm. Got the deal done. We thought we had some of our money back. It was at least safeguarded. Came in the next morning and State Street stock was down 30%. Okay? It's a horrible, horrible sinking feeling. And you have to get stuff done now. And you don't know what the right answer is because there really isn't one. So that happens, hopefully never again, but that will happen occasionally. If you talk to people that lived through the 1987 stock market crash, you hear very similar stories. And it's real. People lose their jobs, right? All the employees, one of my best friends was at Lehman Brothers. He almost hired, I had two job offers when I went to GMO, Lehman Brothers and GMO. I chose well. But anyway, he was at Lehman Brothers, the guy that tried to hire me, and he lost everything. Right? He was a reasonably wealthy guy, had a lot of his personal wealth caught up inside. So I go on that because day to day, every single day is pretty calm. It's a fairly academic environment, for at least in my shop. We're not, you know, diving in and out of the market. It's not like the movie Wall Street where people are on the phone, buy this, buy that, and we're not doing that. But it can get terrifying periodically. It's sort of, you know, what was the phrase? It's sort of long periods of calm and tranquility punctuated by sheer terror.
Yeah.
It is kind of what can happen. And even if you're a quant, even if you're like the computer jockey, you know, the jockey that some of the traders deride you as, you're getting involved, you're still there. So there's a certain adrenaline that comes and goes every now and then. We try and minimize it, but the financial markets are a creation of human behavior, and humans don't behave very rationally most of the time. So,
I can describe a calm day then, because we do get crazy days. So a calm day, which a lot of the days are, I live about 5 kilometers away from work, and I walk to work. It takes me about 50 minutes. It's a nice walk in the morning, and I do the same walk back. A lot of people complain about these walks, but I do them, both at home and at work. And so sometimes I bicycle, sometimes I jog, but, you know, when I come in to work, I can make anything in the company my business by being the chief risk officer, because I can call anything a risk. If we're making a hire, I call it a risk. If we're investing, I call it a risk. If that guy is dressing up differently all of a sudden, I call it a risk. You know, I literally do. That's my job. And so I just walk around the office and I make whatever I want risk. So what I do every day is a lot of fun. I come in and I decide who I'm going to pick on. You know, my favorite is the founder of the company, who just keeps really getting irritated. So for example, it's almost every day I come in. You know, the market's open at 9:30. I walk. I change at a club. I don't wear my work clothes to work. I wear my walking clothes, and then I change there, and then I roll in by 9 o'clock. Most of the traders have been in there much earlier, and sort of and so on. And I'm there before the market's open by about a half hour, and they'll talk to me if they want to make a bigger trade, then we would let them do without questions. So they know what they can do without questions, but if something they want to do in bigger size or something new or something, they know what the rules are. If they want to step outside of them, they talk to me. And so I spend, you know, my morning, you know, looking at, you know, oversized trades or things like that. And that's fun because the trader has to explain it to you and so on and so forth. And then you, by about 10 o'clock, I'm settled at my desk and I'm looking at the portfolio. And that's the most important part of my job and my day, actually, which is around 10 to 11 o'clock, I'm watching the portfolio. How's it responding to the market? The market opened. Copper's down, oil's up, you know, gold's up, gold's down, whatever. And we know how our portfolio should act, you know, when these things happen. Or at least at the close of the day, I know what the portfolio should be. Every day I make this sort of mental game when the profit and loss of the portfolio comes out at about 4:05 or something like that, I guess it. You know, I can do it real time, but most of the time I guess it. But in the morning, I'm basically looking, is the portfolio acting like the way we wanted it to act? And if it isn't, then we start to ask questions. And, you know, I take a fairly extended lunch. I'm an avid, you know, go out for lunch, but I can afford to do that because I'm not a trader. And then I come in the afternoon, and I'm back at the portfolio. Any sort of questions? There's all sorts of things that are going on. We're working on all sorts of longer-term projects and things like that, and meetings, and sometimes investors come in and so on. Do those mostly in the afternoon, and then look how the portfolio is closing. Is a normal sort of, you know, day. But when the markets move, it's all better off. When the markets move is when you get hurt or you make money. Those are the days. In a year, there's about, you know, 20 days or so where it really matters. The rest is kind of, you know.
So I guess a typical day for me looks like this. I get to the office around 8:30 a.m. As soon as I open my computer, the first thing I do is I reply to emails. From, let's say, yesterday I had to deal with a customer that uploaded the same CSV twice, and we had to reset their account and so on. So once I'm done with the emails, the team does the morning check-in, in which we all say what we're going to be working on, what we think might be potential problems for us to hit our goal for the day. After the check-in is done, everyone goes work on their stuff, and I usually start my coding work. So I code basically new features, new machine learning or data mining features for the platform. Most of the time I'm coding when I'm in the office. I'm also in charge of managing the co-op students that we have, which is a lot of work sometimes. I'm also there to help any other member of the team if they need to. If some of our investors are in town, sometimes they ask us to go have lunch with them so that we can update them as to how the company is doing and so on. We also have to meet with customers or potential customers to pitch. I don't do sales for the in the company, but sometimes I have to join if we know that they will be bringing someone more technical and they will be asking more technical questions. So yeah, that's pretty much a typical day for me. Then at the end of the day, we do our checkout in which all of us in the team talk about what we did during the day, if we hit the goal that we had for the day, and if not, why was it? And that's around 6 p.m., at which point most of the team goes home, and only Wojciech and I stay until 8 p.m. usually, from Monday to Friday. Sometimes I go to the office on Saturday when we either interview someone. We always ask them to go interview with us on the weekends. It's more convenient, I guess. So yeah, I go either because of that to the office on a Saturday, or because we really need to push something to get it done over the weekend so that a new feature, for example, is ready for Monday. Yeah. Pretty much. Oh, and sometimes we are a very small team. So if I spent a lot of time doing research, we would probably go out of business, right? So at this point, we don't have an R&D department. Hopefully one day when we're big enough, we will have one. But still, I try to keep up to date with what are the latest developments in machine learning and data mining. To see if we can use some of them for our product. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I would only add one. Yeah, I'd kind of give you the terrifying moments. So my day is much more similar. My research team meets once a week. I have a weekly team meeting. Everyone on the team at some point is expected to present, you know, half an hour, 45-minute presentation on the research project they've been doing. It's not too dissimilar from the seminars you guys probably have here. I do quite a few meetings because I'm the head of our research team, and our research team produces all the models that manage most of our money. So when clients come in and they want to know what we're doing with the money, I'm usually one of the people they want to talk to. So a couple times a week, I probably have to do an hour meeting with a client and explain to them in mostly pretty high level terms what it is we're doing and why and what's on the research agenda. And there's lots of internal meetings, right? I guess I'm in a position in the firm where I have enough, you know, exposure to the bureaucracy, or I'm part of the bureaucracy in some respects, that I have to sit on internal committees and, you know, sit with the, you know, I have to put together a presentation to report to the board of directors, you know, that kind of stuff. It's not that huge of a company, but nonetheless, we do have those corporate type structures in place. Most of the members of my team have nothing to do with that. They're out there doing the research every day. In fact, I try to keep them out of that, unless they, you know, really, really want to talk to one of our clients for whatever reason. And they spend most of their days, you know, thinking about the markets. How do I extract useful information from the data we have? Can I trade that? Can I make money on that? Or just learning about what's going on in the market. You know, he said we have a very good guess every day what our portfolio has done based on looking at just a couple of indicators. And if that's not the case, something's not right, or potentially not right. So we all look at it, and we'll have, you know, there's a weekly a meeting between me and the two other senior people that are, sort of run our group, our whole division. And then there's a monthly meeting where a good chunk of our division comes together and rattles off statistics and data, and we're making sure everything's okay. And a lot of that analysis in those meetings is because the people on the research team or other teams have aggregated data, they're measuring stuff, called attribution analysis. We have a whole bunch of different risk models, none of which I actually believe, because they're not all, none of them are perfect, but you put six of them together and you sort of triangulate your way to a problem, right? And then we have debates, because there is no right answer. So a lot of the meetings are like, well, no, I think this. And it's like, well, no, I think this. Here's this piece of data that supports it, and here's this piece of data that supports it. And I guarantee I can find a piece of data that contradicts both of those things. But that's because there's a huge amount of uncertainty. The error bars in this business are, you know, 10 times the size of the data in some cases, right? So you have to have this very healthy collegial atmosphere where people are sort of feel safe to express concerns, call out more senior people's judgment, for, you know, expose it to closer scrutiny, because the error bars are so big. You need that kind of continual checking and feedback. In a lot of places where firms fall down, and end up making catastrophic mistakes, like they lose all their clients' money, because they don't have good procedures like that in place. They don't have the environment where those kind of conversations can happen.
All right, well, it's been great. Let's thank our panelists.